You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Karina Cordero, Leandro Murillo y
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Been a soldier for 1,000 years.
But I always wanted to be a Marine, and I always wanted to experience war.
Just glorious, the best of the bunch. You know, the day you went in was the day you were stamped. You know, you were able to shave. You were a man.
He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you.
We lost, they lost, the people that lost their lives, whew, too bad.
There were more United States Marine casualties
in Vietnam than there were United States Marine casualties in the entire Second World War.
The day I left, it was like, geez, somebody's pulling me out of hell.
And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan. And he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die. And he never sees the writing on the wall.
I've been through the anger, I've been through the rage and the sorrow and the depression and the alienation and everything. I'm just bitter right now.
We're not the heroes at all. We're the fools.
He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more.
Hey, America, look at these guys. Hey, America, understand what's happened.
And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
It isn't over, but it is ending. It is ending not because of the Paris talks or the demonstrations at home. It is ending because the largest and wealthiest and most powerful organization on earth, the American Army, is being challenged from within, from the very cellars of its pyramid, from the most forgotten, the most brutalized, and certainly the bravest of its members. The war is ending because the grunt is taking no more bullshit.
John,
what?
The Army's calling you, man.
That's right.
another too, man.
Are you going, brother?
Hell no!
Hello, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and first of all, I want to apologize for the lack of a show last week. Well, I want to apologize, but not really. There were some circumstances beyond my control, so I ended up having to play a talk by Michael Parenti for the full 2 hours. But I know those of you who still tuned in weren't overly disappointed, because listening to any talk by him is time well spent. So, this week, I'm going to do what I was going to do last week. Me and a very special guest are going to talk about the Vietnam War. And, of course, you know, those songs from the intro there, Matt Jones, Hell No, I Ain't Gonna Go. And, of course, we had Buffy St. Marie singing, actually, in the introduction to John Pilger's documentary Heroes about the Vietnam War, which is actually an anti-war documentary that he did in the 1980s. Both of those, like, you know, reason I did those intros, of course, you know, like there's going to be quite a few anti-war songs in this show, and obviously there were tons of them at that time. And you ask why I'm doing this, like why now? Because here at Back in the USSR, we are very sensitive to the distortion and rewriting of history, and that's exactly what's been going on with how the Vietnam War has been portrayed in Western media. And while this certainly isn't new, some very blatant examples have emerged recently, including a PBS documentary series, which we're going to talk about, and that effectively whitewashes the whole thing. You know, it was the case back then and remains the case today that mainstream commentators on the Vietnam War can be divided into two groups: the people who thought that the war could be won, and those who thought that it could not be won and concluded it was basically a mistake. People who tell the truth that it was a criminal, brutal, racist, imperialist war are still not welcome in the mainstream capitalist press, and it was the same with the Iraq War. And this has allowed history to be distorted in many ways, most commonly downplaying the American atrocities there as a mistake, or even a good intention mistake. Well, let's look a little at this good intention mistake. The following is an excerpt from an article by Michael Yates in Monthly Review magazine entitled Honor the Vietnamese, not those who killed them. And this section of the article is called McNamara's Business Model of War. And it goes like this. Robert McNamara, President Lyndon Johnson's Secretary of Defense, was the chief architect of the U.S. war strategy. A logistics expert who streamlined Allied bombing runs during the Second World War and later president of Ford Motor Company, McNamara believed that winning a war was simply a matter of setting a goal that would result in victory and then using the managerial techniques he had mastered to get the job done. The goal was to get the kill ratio, the proportion between enemy and U.S. dead, as high as possible, so that a crossover point was reached. That is, more enemy soldiers killed than could be replaced. Then, inevitably, the Vietnamese would no longer be able to resist the U.S. war machine, surrender, and sue for peace. A way to envision what McNamara did is to imagine the war in Vietnam in terms of a capitalist production process. Instead of the accumulation of money capital as the motor force of the system, substitute the accumulation of dead enemy bodies. The U.S. government, through its military, sought to maximize these. However, as McNamara and his superiors and generals knew, the enemy employed guerrilla warfare, refusing to fight set battles, attacking, and then disappearing into the rural landscape. U.S. troops could not easily distinguish soldiers from civilians. Every Vietnamese might be a soldier, even women and children. While no one would admit it, continuously increasing the kill ratio necessarily meant killing as many civilians as possible. And even if it were assumed that any given group of Vietnamese were civilians, the more of them murdered, the more enemy troops would be exposed, and the fewer replacements for those killed would be available. As former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld put it in the context of the current war on terror, the best way that the United States could combat the terrorists was to, quote, drain the swamp they live in. Kill the non-combatants, and only the enemy soldiers will be left. They would no longer have a swamp in which to hide. From the beginning of the war, therefore, killing civilians was a U.S. policy that flowed directly from the goal of maximizing the kill ratio. Killing civilians violates the rules of engagement and is a war crime. So great pains were taken to disguise these as lives taken in battle. And Terse offers numerous examples of this. One common practice was to stage a dead civilian as a soldier by placing an enemy weapon nearby. However, this often was not necessary, as commanding officers were almost always willing to simply take the word of a lieutenant or a captain at the scene. Enemy dead minus U.S. dead, the kill ratio defined as a difference, is not the same as revenue cost revenue minus cost, profits. It has to be monetized to keep the accumulation juggernaut rolling along. Monetization occurred through the auspices of the U.S. government, which we can think of as a gigantic firm with huge cash reserves and an unlimited line of credit, not just at home but around the world. Taxes could be increased, bonds could be sold, money could be printed, and given the world's use of the dollar as a primary reserve currency, payments deficits could be run indefinitely with just about any nation. Money could be provided until the war ended in victory. As any employer knows, the essence of management is control. Given the aim of a maximum kill ratio, every aspect of the production process had to be coordinated as finely as possible. Several kinds of control were important. First, there had to be enough workers, soldiers and support personnel. A virtually unlimited supply of soldiers was guaranteed through the draft. Young men whose families were well-situated and politically influential could avoid the draft through various means, so they would not likely be vocal opponents of the war, an assumption that later proved incorrect. Poor whites, blacks, Hispanics, and American Indians were considered economically expendable, and sending them off to war was a way to contain any discontent and agitation that they might have exhibited at home. Once drafted, soldiers had to be taught to kill. It is not normal for one person to murder another, and there are powerful social taboos against doing so. Researchers had discovered that in the 19th and 20th century wars, soldiers regularly failed to fire their rifles or intentionally aimed to miss their targets. Military leaders responded to this by dramatically altering the methods used to train troops. They sought to forge extreme group solidarity in two ways. First, drill instructors subjugated new recruits to constant torment bordering on torture. If you deprive trainees of food and sleep, force them to make long marches under adverse conditions, punish them severely for any failure to obey orders, no matter how ridiculous or demeaning, you break down their defenses and make them willing to do whatever you say. In other words, forging them into homogenous mass, a unit that will act as one. Not adhering to what any rational person would consider an insane regimen becomes unthinkable. Failure to do so marks you as a sissy, fag, cunt, or girl, and subjects you to physical and emotional torment from both superiors and comrades. Second, instructors then tied their charges misery to the evil intentions of subhuman foreigners. In the case of Vietnam, to the gooks, slopes, slant eyes, yellow bastards, and the Kong. Exhausted, angry, afraid, they gradually embraced the chance of kill the gooks, kill the gooks. By the time they got to the war zones, they were ready to kill. Not for a noble cause, but for their buddies, and because those they were going to murder were no different than the animals they might have hunted back home. Is it any wonder that more than a few U.S. troops were willing to kill civilians? In a hostile country, hot, dirty, diseased from constant marches and firefights in jungle terrain, seeing their buddies blown to pieces, beginning to wonder why they were there, constantly pressured to keep their kills high and rewarded for doing so. They were not always adverse to shooting people, torturing them, raping women, and generating as much violent mayhem as possible. And lest we think that the rank and file soldiers were primarily to blame for the slaughter, their officers were too often bloodthirsty, racist killers. Seeing the war as a ticket to career advancement, Colin Powell, who helped cover up My Lai, is a case in point. And no doubt frequently believing that what they taught the grunts about the Vietnamese was true. As Chief Commanding Officer William Westmoreland infamously said, quote, "The Oriental doesn't put the same high price on life as does a Westerner. We value life and human dignity. They don't care about life and human dignity." It was the officers who directed the soldiers. It was they who covered up the war crimes. It was they who devised the methods of torture employed in the field. And it was they who devised the ever more sadistic tactics that resulted in the orders to kill anything that moves. In addition to its own soldiers, the United States also employed troops, mercenaries in effect, from South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and other countries, as well as civilian and quasi-military support personnel. It also paid for much of the military of South Vietnam, which, while ostensibly independent, was in reality subject to U.S. control. All these were on board with the McNamara program, and some of them added their own unique talents to the killing. PSYOPs, psychological operations, the establishment of strategic hamlets to house those forced from their homes and farms, assassination campaigns and torture techniques were employed by these personnel throughout the war. A production process requires non-human inputs, what Marx calls constant capital. In Vietnam, this mainly comprised of weapons of mass destruction, from claymore mines, tanks, helicopter gunships, battleships, and B-52 bombers, to napalm, Agent Orange, white phosphorus, and other ingredients from the enormous U.S. chemical arsenal. The United States had a virtually unlimited supply of these means of death, and it had a limitless willingness to employ them. Soldiers of all ranks were trained to utilize mass destruction machinery in every situation. Even those where collateral damage to civilians was inevitable. So now we have money capital from the enormous funds of the U.S. government transformed into capital in the form of labor power and constant capital. These were then combined on the battlefields as efficiently as possible with a labor process controlled through the rigorous training of the soldiers and support personnel who would do what they were told or would act automatically to make certain that the kill ratio was high and rising. Finally, the kill ratio had to be sold so that the accumulation of dead bodies could be expanded. This was not done, of course, in the traditional way of selling. Rather, it was sold through diligent and relentless propaganda fed to the press, the general public, and the politicians who ultimately had to agree on continual funding. There was always light at the end of the tunnel. The United States was slowly but surely winning the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese. The puppet governments that the United States put in power in South Vietnam were committed to democracy, and the people were flocking to their banners. To make these absurd claims plausible, all manner of lies had to be repeated to keep ugly truths from the light of day. The military and the state were adept at this. Few enlisted soldiers and almost no officers were prosecuted for the thousands of war crimes they committed. Those that were received minimal sentences, and no matter how dramatic the horrors that did get investigated and published, such as the mass murder at My Lai, the government was able to contain the damage by waiting for the certain waning of public interest and outrage, while trotting out the argument that such horrendous events were rare and the work of, quote, a few bad apples. Thus, the capital expended in the production of corpses was repeatedly monetized and the accumulation of capital proceeded apace. Judged by the carnage, McNamara's war by scientific management was a great success. Ter sums up what the U.S. forces did. Murder, torture, rape, abuse, forced displacement, home burnings, specious arrests, imprisonment without due process, such occurrences were virtually a daily fact of life throughout the years of American presence in Vietnam. He gives hundreds of examples, enough to convince us that these barbarous acts were official policy. Tourists also made tours of the Vietnamese countryside and found that in every village, no matter how small and isolated, peasants had constructed memorials with the names of dead villagers, many victims of unreported routine atrocities. Terce also gives several accounts of colonels and generals who monomaniacally pursued high kill ratios by whatever means possible. In February 1968, General Julian Ewell gained command of the Mekong Delta region of Vietnam, a densely populated area of more than 5 million people. Ewell and his subordinate, Colonel Ira Hunt, proceeded to go berserk, directing the killing of so many civilians that he won the nickname Butcher of the Delta. The 9th Infantry Division he commanded had been averaging a kill ratio of about 9. That is 9 dead enemy for every U.S. soldier killed. Spurred on by the government's Operation Speedy Express, set in motion because President Johnson and his war planners wanted the Delta under the control of the South Vietnamese government pending upcoming peace talks with North Vietnam, as well as his own psychosis, Ewell initiated a reign of terror. 14 months later, the kill ratio was an astonishing 134. Given the way the Vietnamese liberation forces fought, refusing to engage in large-scale battles, nearly all the dead had to be civilians. While it is important to provide verifiable evidence of war crimes the United States committed in Vietnam, it is also useful to supply data in the overall tolls of death, injury, social and ecological ruin heaped upon the Vietnamese and their country. The following summary data, which include damage done to Cambodia and Laos, countries to which the war spread as a result of secret U.S. bombing campaigns, still have the power to shock. As many as 1.7 million revolutionary forces were killed, but 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers were killed, more than 65,000 North Vietnamese civilians died, mainly victims of U.S. bombing raids, which targeted factories, hospitals, schools, and dikes, more or less indiscriminately killing people. At least 4 million Vietnamese died as a direct result of the war, which means that at least 2 million civilians perished at the hands of U.S. forces and their mercenary brethren. When the war commenced in earnest in the 1960s, Vietnam's population was 19 million. An incredible 21% of this population therefore perished. In 1960, the U.S. population was about 180 million. Imagine a war that killed nearly 38 million Americans. Tourist sources estimate the extent of the civilian wounded as follows. A brief accounting shows 8,000 to 16,000 South Vietnamese paraplegics, 30,000 to 60,000 South Vietnamese left blind, and some 83,000 to 166,000 South Vietnamese amputees. Total civilian wounded were at least 5.3 million. More bombs were dropped on Vietnam than by all sides in all previous wars throughout history, and three times more than by all sides in the Second World War. 19 million gallons of herbicide poisoned the land. 9,000 of 15,000 hamlets were destroyed in South Vietnam. In the north, all six industrial cities were devastated. 28 of 30 provincial towns and 96 of 116 district towns were leveled by bombing. The United States threatened to use nuclear weapons 13 times. Nixon chided his national security advisor and soon-to-be Secretary of State Henry Kissinger for being too squeamish about this and the massive bombing campaign of the North Nixon ordered in 1972. Nixon said he himself just did not give a damn. After the war, the unexploded bombs and mines permeated the landscape and took an additional 42,000 lives. Millions of acres have still not been cleared of live ordnance. Agent Orange and other defoliants have caused severe health problems for millions of Vietnamese. Nearly all of Vietnam's triple canopy forests were destroyed. 3 million tons of ordnance struck 100,000 sites during the secret war in Cambodia, causing widespread social dislocation, destruction of crops, and starvation. The U.S. bombing campaign in Cambodia was directly responsible for the rise of the Khmer Rouge under Pol Pot and the genocide which took place afterward. The United States actually sided with Pol Pot when the Vietnamese troops finally ended his reign of terror. 2,756,941 tons of ordnance were dropped in Laos on 113,716 sites. Much of the Laotian landscape was blown to bits. Still think it was all an honest mistake, brothers and sisters.
The sick, the young, the lame, we do our best to kill and maim, because the kills all count the same. Napalm sticks to kids. Flying low across the trees, pilots doing what they please, dropping frags on refugees. Napalm sticks to kids. Flying low and looking mean, see that family by the stream, drop some nape and hear them scream. Napalm sticks to kids. A group of gooks in the grass, but all the fighting's long since past. Crispy youngsters in a mass. Napalm sticks to kids. Drop some napalm on the barn, it won't do much harm. Just burn off a leg or an arm. Napalm sticks to kids. Gather kids as you fly over town by tossing candy on the ground. Then grease them when they gather round. Napalm sticks to kids. Ox cart rolling down the road, peasants with a heavy load. They're all VC when the bombs explode. Napalm sticks to kids. Cobras flying in the sun, killing gooks is macho fun. It's one pregnant, it's two for one. Napalm sticks to kids. There's a gook down on her knees, lonesome full of chets into the breeze. Her arms are nailed to the trees. Napalm sticks to kids. Blues out on a road recon, see some children with their mom. What the hell, let's drop the bomb. Napalm sticks to kids. They're in good shape for the shape they're in, but God, I wonder how they can win with napalm running down their skin. Napalm sticks to kids. CIA with guns for hire, Montingrads around the fire. Napalm makes the fire higher. Napalm sticks to kids. A baby sucking on his mother's tit, children cowering in a pit. Dow Chemical doesn't give a shit. Napalm sticks to kids. Teen kids in a no-fire zone, books on their arm as they go home. Last in line goes home alone. Napalm sticks to kids.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.